Welcome to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Michael W. Dean of the Freedom Fiends cooks up a very special blend of liberty, guns, sex, rock and roll, drugs, and thriving in spite of the state in an increasingly worrying world. All with a rotating cast of nifty guests who are also up in the middle of the night.
Fiend phone, fiend phone, fiend phone, fiend phone.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you okay. Is this Justin Longo?
Yes, it is. Last I checked.
Calling in for your interview?
I am. I'm excited because I have no idea what we're going to chat about. All right, I am on the Freedom Fiends show. Michael Dean's little anarchist crazy hellhole up in Wyoming.
Yeah, that's what we're doing. That's it. You're right. So, Justin, who are you and what do you do?
I am the Justin Longo that you may have heard from the interwebs and Facebook fame. Maybe that's all in my head, but I live in Denver, Colorado, and I work for the Independence Institute, and I just wanted to clarify for my fellow coworkers and my career that whatever I'm about to say is completely independent of my work, and I'm saying this strictly as myself, Justin, and not as an Independence Institute employee. So I also have a couple of
projects. This is independent of the Independence Institute, what you're doing now?
Yes, sir, absolutely.
All right.
I am speaking on my own terms. I also do a couple of side projects. The first one is a national social networking club, so to speak, called Liberty on the Rocks, and it is basically our answer to the drinking liberally left-wing club that is pretty much in every city in the United States. And we had this idea to kind of respond with our own free market drinking club, so to speak, from back in 2008. So we're 4 years strong and got about 18 chapters across the United States and a couple in Canada. So we're doing pretty well. And then I have a side project website called CompleteColorado.com, and that's basically a state aggregated news source. So if anybody's interested in Colorado news at all, then they can just come to our site and not have to go anywhere else because we aggregate and slant news in the liberty/free market perspective. So those are my two little side projects.
It's interesting that you use the word slant because I believe that all news is slanted in some direction, and when confronted about it, most news sources deny that and use words like fair and balanced.
Yeah, I agree with you, and we are out and about, and we are fully upfront and honest about our slant on the day's headlines, and we update several times a day, and you know, I'm very, very much in tune with what's going on, and I love to break down the narrative that we're being fed from whatever news source that we're getting it from. So I just love, you know, linking to a site or linking to a story rather that talks about, you know, helping or incentivizing green energy and just blatantly calling it, you know, taxpayer subsidies to X and Y. So we definitely paint all the news stories from that perspective, and we are unequivocally, unabashedly free market and libertarian oriented. So that's the way we view it.
What's your opinion on green energy, various aspects of it?
Wow, that's a big one. In general, I think that green energy probably has a chance to become as efficient as fossil fuels eventually. It doesn't look like the technology is there yet because they can't stand on their own 2 feet, and they can only exist in the market, if you even want to call it a market, via tax subsidies of some sort, tax shelters and direct subsidies and different protection schemes. So until they can exist without being helped along at the rate that they're being helped along, I mean, because oil companies get some subsidies as well, but it's like, you know, a million times more for renewable energies. Until they can exist on their own, then they're basically signaling to the whole world that they, you know, are not efficient enough and they don't produce enough energy per kilowatt hour and all that good stuff. So I think eventually the technology will get there, but we're just not there at that point.
I think if the government got out of the way, we could get there in the free market.
That's a good point, because I think that when you step into the game and you start playing favorites with subsidies and protections, then you are very likely to be playing favorites for a losing enterprise, and you're propping up something that is obviously not efficient, but then would have been the wrong path, and the market would have taken a different path and gotten there much quicker. So it could be retarding the growth, so to speak, of the renewable energy industry by picking winners and you know, crushing a source of renewable energy that would have made it, you know, 10 years ago, or would have made it next year if they had been left alone. So
I think that that's a oh, and by the way, if I didn't explain the format of the show, it's more of a conversation than an interview, which is why I'm talking so much. I think that a big difference, you know, other than a big difference between right wingers and libertarians, us being libertarians, you consider yourself a libertarian, right?
Yeah, I mean, I loosely speaking, yes, I would call myself a nonviolent or a voluntarist in our circles, but yeah, to the common man, I would paint myself as a libertarian for sure.
Same here. I have problems with all the common labels, but yeah, I live by the non-aggression principle, and I devote my life to pointing out to people what the non-aggression principle is, basically. The difference between, and you do a lot of that too. I mean, it seems like you devote your day job is that, and your night job, you know, your hobbies are that too. It seems like a big difference between right-wingers and libertarians is, while we agree on a lot of the same problems of the world, like I could sit down and discuss the failure of Solyndra being indicative of what's wrong with government all day long, and so could, you know, anybody on Fox. But aside from the fact that everyone on Fox, most people on Fox, with the exception of the one or two libertarians, I think one of them's been fired, most of those people do want the government to point its guns in certain directions. And kind of the big thing I'm thinking is they dismiss things like green energy entirely because the left is pointing its guns to try to finance it. Whereas to me, I think it's an extremely viable idea. It's just not something the government should be financing and regulating. I mean, think about the innovations. Think about where the biggest innovations have happened in our lifetimes. How old are you?
I'm 29.
Okay, I'm 48 this week. But in our lifetimes, in the gamut between those two ages, you know, the biggest thing that's happened is computers. And computers have advanced further than any other technology in a short period of time, largely because the advances, once there was comparable hardware to run it on, most of the advances took place in software, and that's something anybody could do from anywhere, and it was not under a lot of regulation. And it seems to me like a really good example of an industry to be followed. I mean, a lot of regulation is coming in now and has come in with software sales and things at times, but I think if the government disappeared, it'd be great. But I think if the government even backed off a bunch on innovation, you know, even to just start a business now, to get a business license, to hire people, to, you know, have to give them insurance, things like that. Talk a little bit about how you see how that could work in a freer market.
Well, leaving an industry alone is by far the best option. I think I want to make a comment about what you said earlier about the difference between conservatives and libertarians in a general sense. I think that was very, very insightful. I think that when a conservative is confronted with an idea from whom they consider on the other side or the other team, you know, their Red Sox to the Yankees that they enjoy, they have this, you know, this total lose-lose situation in their minds, and a total disconnect and shut off from what those ideas are because it's coming, because of where the source where it's coming
to
from.
To the point where, like, the average Republican thinks that solar power is evil or unworkable. You know, I mean, I actually saw this picture of this interview with Romney where he was talking about how he wanted to keep all drugs outlawed. And he was standing next to a giant barrel of oil. And one of the commenters said he looks like he's standing next to his running mate. And he really is. Like, for a Republican, a big barrel of oil is your running mate. And, you know, solar power or wind power is like, you know, the devil's playground or something.
Yeah. Let me give you an example from Colorado. And this is a real life, absolutely 100% true example. It, because the left is associated, for good or bad, with bicycles and bicycle programs, the right is vehemently anti-bike in almost all respects. And when there is a bike share program that came to Denver, it was considered by the right here in Colorado as a, quote, UN conspiracy. Yes, you heard that right. A United Nations conspiracy. And it wasn't just the tinfoil hat GOPers. It was the mainstream GOPers who latched onto this narrative because, you know, bikes are from the other side and the other team likes bikes, so we can't like bikes.
And China, you know, likes bikes. Hang on just a sec. I have a call I got to get rid of. I'm going to keep recording because that's how we roll.
All right.
Nima Vedati, it's Michael Dean. I'm recording an Anarchy Gumbo with Justin Longo. You're live on the air. How you doing, Nima?
Yo, you told me to call you, and then you go and put me live on the air?
Well, you know, I'm cheating on you with some other libertarian. Real quick, would you be interested in podcasting tonight? Later, in like an hour, 45 minutes.
Okay, call you in an hour.
Yeah, instead of doing it tomorrow. In 45 minutes. I'll call you when I get off this. All right, thanks, man. Bye. All right, that's how we roll on the Anarchy Gumbo. So go on.
All right, so what I was getting at was that it is by accident, by pure accident, that the right was rightfully against a government program. I mean, they were against the bike share government subsidized program.
Well, a stop clock is right once a year, you know.
Yeah, and the point is they were against it not because it's a government program, but because it was bikes, you know, and I'm against it because it's a government program that's using stolen money to create some stupid thing out of thin air that probably wouldn't exist without stolen money.
Bikes probably remind them of China too. Did that come up? A lot of people ride bikes in China.
No, it didn't, but it's strange. Yeah, I didn't. That may be kind of tangentially what they were angry about too, but they were just against it, not out of any sort of principle, but just simply because it was something that was associated with the other side. And, you know, I'm more mad at somebody who is against something for the wrong reasons than just being completely ignorant about the subject, or even the left who was in favor of, you know, bikes and subsidizing bike shares and stuff, because, you know, they're touting our words, they're playing into our ideology half the time in the media, and it's for the wrong reason. And then when I go around saying that this program is stupid and it's bad because it's using stolen money, well, then I get looked at like, you know, you just don't like bikes, or, you know, you don't like it because it's a Democrat idea or something. And it distorts what the real issue is.
There's a lot of Democrat. I hate Democrats. I used to be a Democrat, and I hate Republicans too, most of them, except Ron Paul. I pretty much hate voting and politics, but there's a lot of Democrat ideas I like. You know, I like the idea of legalizing gay marriage, although I think that the government should get out of marriage. I like the idea of decriminalizing marijuana, although I think it should be completely left alone and unregulated and untaxed. But, you know, they both sides, both teams are about 10% right and about 90% wrong, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think that both sides have their issues where they are correct, but I put a lot more blame on the right because, again, they go around spouting off about liberty and freedom and personal responsibility while, with the other hand and outside the other, you know, out of the other side of their mouth, they're destroying those ideas and concepts. And I'm almost, you know, I'm scared to even use the Gadsden flag because they've totally co-opted it and used it for their means.
Well, they've co-opted it, and you know, it can get you arrested now.
What do you mean?
There was a DHS internal memo that got leaked and a Michigan State Police internal memo that got leaked that were basically like signs that people might be a terrorist and you should turn them into us. And one of them was displaying the Gadsden flag.
Wow. Okay. I didn't know the police state was that sophisticated now.
Well, since I do two Liberty podcasts that have a lot of listeners, I get about 2 emails an hour, 24 hours a day of people sending in tyranny headlines. So I know more than I'd like to about it. I think about it more than I'd like to. Oh, this was from like 2 years ago, man. This is, you know, I mean, I can't even keep up. The tyranny, you know, I take notes for the shows I do with Nima Wednesdays and Sundays on Freedom Fiends. And, you know, it's a text document. And like, I sent him the one last night for the notes to look at. And then like this morning I had to send him an updated version because so much tyranny had happened overnight or been posted about overnight.
Oh man.
one that's interesting, man. Do you know about this chick that got busted and turned in all her friends?
No, enlighten me. Cause it sounds sort of familiar, but what's the story?
This libertarian activist named Stacey Litz, who is, you know, by all accounts, a good one. I mean, she was a member of Students for Liberty, Drexel Student Liberty Front, Center for Stateless Society, and other activist outlets, got busted with a bunch of drugs and did a plea deal where she turned a bunch, you know, busted a bunch of her friends and then like was outed as having done this and wasn't valuable enough to her captors to where they reneged on the deal. So she has the worst of both worlds. You know, she sold out her values to get out of prison, and she's internationally known now as having done this, and she's still going to prison.
Wow. Yeah, I did hear about an SFL, C4SS person flipping, but I didn't know the extent of the story. That's insane. That is the worst of both worlds.
Yeah.
Oh man.
It's horrible. So back to the left-right fake dichotomy. You know, I mean, I just look at it as like government is a like it's a football league where there's only two teams, they both suck, and they won't let any good teams into the league.
Yeah, and if you threaten the league with a new idea, then they put you in their, you know, their stadium's jail cell or something.
Yeah. Yep. So what do you like to do for activism, and where do you see the world? Well, let me ask you the first question first. What do you like to do?
Well, I've got the two side projects going on, and I'm excited about Liberty on the Rocks because we are expanding and we're trying to take it to the next level and do bigger and better stuff. That's, I guess, outside of what I do personally, just day to day. I try to engage as many people as I can just in my day to day activities with, you know, the message of there's a gun in the room and we need to point it out and not wave the gun around any longer in the words of Stefan Molyneux.
Explain the gun in the room. I mean, most of the people that listen to the Anarchy Gumbo podcast know what we're talking about when we say that, but not everybody. For some reason, based on like, you know, I used to write tech books that people liked and, you know, I get a few fans that don't know what that means. Go ahead and explain the gun in the room.
Well, the gun in the room is simply the force, the government force that no one wants to talk about. And it's the government force that does not allow you to disagree with their policy or else you face imprisonment or worse. And the way I phrase it, and I've had a lot of success, and I owe a lot of it to Molyneux, in a lot of the, most of the success, almost all of it, is with the left-leaning personnel that I run into. For example, there is a cashier at a little grocer, a really small natural grocer right by my work, and I had this conversation. I had conversations with her over weeks, and the first conversation I had with her, I just picked up that she had to be in favor of raw milk. I knew it. I guessed it, and I was right. And so my example to uncover the gun in the room was, you know, do you think it is morally just that I should go to jail for selling you raw milk? And she was like, of course not. And I explained that, you know, this is the system that is set up where if something like as innocuous as raw milk is made illegal in some respect, and you and I want to engage in a voluntary trade with said raw milk, well, then we both face the prospects of imprisonment based on that voluntary trade.
Did you turn her?
I got her to understand where I was coming from, and I got her to admit that she did not like funding things that she disagreed with. I got her with the whole killing children in Afghanistan with her money and, you know, imprisoning her friends and people that she's never met for, you know, leaves in their pockets, you know, things like that. And she was like, yeah, I never really thought of it like that, you know, that we face jail and prison, and if we don't choose to fund that which we find immoral. And I was like, you realize that you are going to jail or you will be shot if you don't fund these things like putting people in prison for raw milk. And she conceded those points and was pretty kind of, I mean, it's the facial expressions that you see when somebody first hears these ideas, I guess, are really interesting. And it took her a couple of encounters to really chew on that. And then she kind of was more inquisitive. And then out of the blue, and this is where I feel like I had the most success, because she was always going to agree with me about nonviolence and the raw milk thing, but I had my Mises Institute tie on one day, and sure enough, like the next encounter after we chatted about the Mises Institute was, she was like, oh, what were those economists' names again? Because I want to read about them. And I was like, oh, sure. Ludwig von Mises and Murray Rothbard, and, you know, and I was like, holy, and she was like, I want to learn about these
excellent
economists that were
excellent
on your tie. You know, and so that was incredible to me, because it was a completely different direction than anybody on the left I ever thought anybody on the left could have, in going in towards the economics, and not, you know, we wouldn't just concentrate on the nonviolent stuff, which I always concentrate on with the left, because they like to think of themselves as being nonviolent, and they want to promote nonviolence. And when you point out the gun in the room, they do not like that, and so they will always shy away from that. So
it's interesting trying to take someone on a journey like that. I mean, it took me like 7 years, really. You know, it went from, I mean, I voted for Nancy Pelosi at one point in my life when I lived in California, and I was a lazy Democrat, but I was a Democrat, and I believed that. You know, long story short, someone tried to break into my house. I bought some guns. My wife and I started carrying guns, and then we just had to move out of the state because we had to move somewhere where we could carry, and then started to read more. And I think I've got to the point now where an intelligent person, I can take them on the whole journey in about 10 minutes, but it doesn't always work like that. And sometimes people get seasick going that fast. You know, the problem that I have, I encounter with a lot of attempts like that is, you can get someone to agree the single purpose activism thing, the I care about milk, or I care about weed, or I care about anti-war, or I care about gay rights. But it's really hard to get people to admit that to really fully back their right for that thing, they have to back the right for things they don't like guns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's when you know that they really got it, because, you know, it takes a while for people to apply what you're saying universally. And I think that the only way you can really start off with somebody is to guess at what you know that they'll agree with, and use that as the linchpin, and point out the gun in the room with something that they are sympathetic to, and then eventually you've planted the seed, and eventually they can hopefully they will apply it universally. But you don't expect that on the first try. And what I'm trying to do in my day to day life is just plant as many of these seeds as I can, and you know, 5 years from now, when they've heard it maybe 5 more times, 10 more times, it'll finally click and it makes sense. And I'm trying to, you know, with Living on the Rocks as well, normalize these ideas and make them so they're not, you know, you're not a freak if you talk about this stuff. And when they hear it 10 times, it's not so freaky anymore. It's more normal.
Yeah.
And so I'm really trying to do that as well.
Cool.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast, a tasty stew of freedom and fun. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's KittyFeet.com.
So I like the idea of the Liberty on the Rocks. Did you start that?
Yeah, I'm one of three co-founders. The story is actually pretty interesting. It was fate, if you will. We had this idea in 2008, like I said, and we knew it could work. We just didn't really know the finer details of how we could make it work. And so one of the other co-founders, Joe, and I went to New York City for a conference, a tech conference, and we happened to go to a bar that was called Rudy's Bar. It's in Hell's Kitchen, Manhattan. And this happened to be the place, and this is, honest to God, I mean, we had no idea where we were going. Rudy's Bar is where Drinking Liberally started, where the first Drinking Liberally meeting ever took place. And so we found this out when we went into the bar and we saw this big Drinking Liberally flag, and we're like, oh my God, this is crazy. Talked to the owner, and sure enough, that's where it started. So we were like, we have to talk to the guy who started it, because we have questions about how we can start our own thing like his. And so we ended up meeting up with the founder of Drinking Liberally, Justin Krebs, the following night, and we just clandestinely asked him questions about how he got it going and what was successful, what worked, what didn't work. And so it was fate. I mean, it was incredible that we met this guy. And so we went back to Colorado armed with that knowledge, and we knew we could make it work, and we just started with the Denver chapter. And I guess, like I said previously, we have 18 chapters scattered across the United States and in Canada, and we are expanding like wildfire.
Cool. How many chapters?
18, I believe.
Excellent. Excellent. And how often do people meet, and how many people usually at one of these events?
Well, we suggest that they do bi-monthly, so every other week. And the ones around me that I get to go to most often are like first and the third Wednesdays, or second and fourth Mondays, those kind of schedules. And from what I've seen, some chapters can pull in, you know, 30 people consistently. Some pull in 40, 50 people consistently. We've had probably 60 people, 65 people at some points, you know, for a big Christmas party or something like that, or when somebody relatively known is speaking. So it varies, but I would say twice a month and about 30 people is pretty average.
Awesome. Anybody ever get really obnoxious and bum everyone out? That seems to be possible when you have things open to the public.
Yeah, you know, the only problems we've come across so far are, I guess we had maybe one or two chapters that had a whole bunch of 9/11 truthers that were just like poisoning the chapters, so we had to shut them down. And we had a chapter or two that focused way too much on having politicians come, and we tisk and shut, we'll shut you down if you do too much politic crap. We don't, you know, we state from the beginning that we are absolutely, completely apolitical. We don't want to have anything to do with the political process or politicians or any of that crap. We deal with ideas, philosophy, and We kind of used the rubric of Brian Kaplan's The Myth of the Rational Voter to, you know, get these people, get our new chapter leaders to understand, you know, just where we're coming from, and that, you know, we're trying to educate, and philosophize and strike the root as much as we can. And, you know, that politician that's down the road means nothing. And we don't want to have, you know, them coming in and legitimizing what they're doing. And so that's kind of where we're coming from.
Explain strike the root for any listeners who don't know what that means.
Well, strike the root to me is really getting at the heart of the issue. And then for me, striking the root is uncovering the violence of the state. So a lot of people will get mad at things like, green energy, some government program of some sort. You know, they get mad at, the government's spent 2 years paving the road in front of my house, and they're not done. They're so inefficient, and really, they're not getting at the heart of the matter. And the heart of the matter is that, yeah, of course they're inefficient because they don't have to be. They don't have to be efficient.
I call that Hank Hill activism, you know, Hank Hill from King of the Hill. The only time he ever like fights City Hall and ends up winning and making speeches about liberty and personal rights are when it involves like his lawn or something.
Yeah, and that's where people feel the effects of the state, and what they're feeling are just mere tentacles of the state. I mean, they're feeling like the leaves on the branches of the state. They're not striking the root of the state, and the root of the state is the ability for them to jail you and steal from you at will. So striking the root is just uncovering what the state is, and not, you know, the tiny things that they do that affect your daily life.
You've seen my movie Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom, right?
I have.
Which was half of the weed part was filmed in Denver. The gun part was filmed in Wyoming. There's a scene in there where there's a character actually played by me. There was supposed to be another actor, but he didn't show up. So I did it where I'm being one of those Hank Hill activists. I'm standing in my driveway, watering the driveway for no good reason. And I look into the camera and say, I want to know what this government's going to do to fix up my driveway, which is literally something a guy on my block said to me one day.
Wow.
I'm basically making fun of my neighbor and playing my neighbor in that scene. I'm whispering because my windows are open.
Well, I think I'm going to start using that term and then maybe footnoting you when I use it, the Hank Hill activism.
I just made that up, but it's pretty good. It does fit, man.
That's dead on. I mean, I think that's what a lot of people do, because that's what they find easy and that's palatable to the general public, because everybody can identify with, you know, whatever the grievance of the month is. But, you know, most people don't identify with, disagree with me or die, you know, give your money or your life scenarios that we get from the root of government.
Yeah, did you see that video from about a year ago on YouTube? It was some guy in Connecticut, some city or county in Connecticut decided that people having basketball hoops in their driveway was dangerous to public safety and just came in with bulldozers and removed them. Did you ever see that video?
I did see a video. I saw a video of a dad getting really, really angry with some city worker or something about a basketball hoop, and I bet you that's what it was.
Yeah, it was filmed. It was filmed by a family member, and it was the husband and wife screaming at the county. And it was such a good microcosm of the state to me, because it was three people. It was a bureaucrat and a cop and the bulldozer driver. You know, it was like it was the person who makes the laws, the man with the gun who enforces them, and, you know, the machine of aggression to carry it out, all in one scene showing up at the same time.
And how poetic, how beautiful.
Yeah. And I got a dozen of them. And, I was thinking about it. Like, I listened to the whole video. It was like 15 minutes long. I listened to it a couple times, and the stuff the guy was yelling, I mean, everything he said was correct. You know, they don't have any right to do this. And the state lied and said, you know, that they would take it down, but he could keep it. And they just took it away. And a couple, you know, and they said, you know, they told him he has you know, time to appeal it, and they lied and didn't give him time to appeal it. And just, you know, it's my property. Get off my property. What are you doing? And everything he was saying, like, sounded like libertarianism 101, but also other things he was saying led me to know that he was not an activist. He was not someone that ever considered any of this before. And I'm not bashing him at all. I mean, literally, I'm thinking, like, he literally became a libertarian in some way on the spot because it came to his house. The problem is getting people who haven't had, you know, haven't been busted for plants or haven't had, you know, raw milk raids or haven't had their basketball hoop taken away to consider these things. Talk a little bit more about how you, I guess, turn people. That sounds kind of sinister, or like, you know, or indoctrinate people. I mean, but really that's what it is. That's what I do. I try to, every piece of art, I've been making art my whole life. I've been making, you know, audio, video, film, web stuff, and am really good at it to the point where what I do for a living is write books on how to do it. But at some point I decided, like, you know, it doesn't matter how badass this rock and roll song is, it's not about anything. So everything I do now is about showing people the gun in the room. You know, and I don't really like in-person activism. I'm not shy. I don't mind people, but I like to be able to walk away, for one thing. Like, I don't think I personally would like Liberty on the Rocks, and that's more my problem than anything else. Of just, I don't drink, but if I did and started arguing with people, I'd probably violate the non-aggression principle. I'm kidding. But, you know, I like to, like, make a podcast or make a movie and hand it to people and walk away. And if they have follow-up questions, I'll answer them. But I'm not really a people person. I kind of do things one way. You seem to do things more two-way. Talk a little bit more about your experiences with people. I really liked what you said about the woman at the health food store, but talk more about specific people and what you learned from it and what other people can learn going forward.
Yeah, I think engaging people is really important, and you're engaging people as well. You're just not engaging them in real time and in person. I find that I'm so comfortable with these ideas that I've been mulling over in my head for a decade now, ever since I went to George Mason in 2000. Well, I guess geez, now it's been 12 years.
Who were your teachers at George Mason that were important to you?
Oh, man. Without a doubt, Brian Kaplan was probably the number one most influential teacher, even though I took him, I guess, for labor economics, and I just felt like I could talk to him about anything. And outside of him, I had a great student teacher for public choice economics, and that was amazing because I felt like I was on his level, and we had really honest, frank chats about the state and things like that. I mean, the George Mason Econ Department is like 90% anarchist. I mean, that's not any secret or anything like that. But
yeah, that's why I asked. Really, I knew that.
Yeah. I mean, Pete Betke, and you know, there's the whole public choice school is so on point, and it's hard to describe it's like being a vampire in the scene of The Shining when the blood comes out of the elevators. I was enveloped with this thing that I was thirsting for at such a high rate, and I was just immersed in it up to my eyeballs, and I just lived this magical life for like 5, 6, 7 years when I was there, and I learned so much, and it's obviously changed me and changed who I am and what I'm doing now. So it was just an invaluable experience, and I would suggest anybody that if they care at all about liberty or freedom and economics, then there's really only one place to go in the country. I mean, if you really cared about learning from the best of the best. So I just accidentally went there. I mean, it was nothing to do with econ, but I'm fortunate that I accidentally chose that university.
I've exchanged a bunch of emails with Brian Kaplan. He's a really smart, really good guy. Are you or were you ever involved in politics? It sounds like now you're completely out of the voting, out of the, you know, Libertarian Party activism. But on your Facebook, I think I saw, you know, things you like. One of them was Libertarian Party. Were you involved in that, and are you anymore?
I was for about 9 months. I was the legislative director for Colorado, and I wanted to see how the vehicle of the LP here in Colorado, since it's like the founding state of the LP. How that worked for getting the messaging out and using like the megaphone of the party. You know, could we reach more souls using that megaphone rather than, you know, my little mouth? And it was just too much for me to handle at that time. I had so many things going on. I wouldn't be able to do it now either, but I took that role on and did the best I could for, you know, 9 months, and then just said, this isn't as effective as I'd like it to be, and B, I don't have enough time to do everything I want to do, and this is the lowest on the totem pole. So I got out of it in less than a year. But I think there is some good people in the LP here that I know personally that are very education-minded and just want to use the vehicle for megaphone purposes, and I think that's a great thing. And then but the majority of the people there, you know, want to run candidates and stuff like that. And I was always kind of held my tongue and was against that kind of stuff. Of we need this whole slate of candidates. And
do you vote now?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, I have a saying: is smart Democrats become Republicans, smart Republicans become libertarians, smart libertarians become minarchists, and smart minarchists become anarchists.
Oh yeah, that's.
Which was my journey. Other people, you know, your mileage may vary, but.
I think that's really true. I'm not sure. So I would say that the journey either starts either from the conservative or, I guess, the
liberal.
One of the false dichotomy sides. You start from there, and then you kind of make your way to libertarianism or Ron Paul libertarianism, then you go to minarchism, and then you finally run out of excuses and you're tired of the contradictions and you're tired of making the circle square and square the circle. So you're just, you know, you go, you know what, this is silly, and I'm going to be consistent and say that, you know, stealing at any rate is bad. You know, stealing 1% is bad and stealing 30% is bad. So
I agree, although I'm in favor of having less percent stolen from me. I know that morally it doesn't matter, but you know, for the neat things I can buy, it does matter.
Yeah, I'm sympathetic to that. I'm sympathetic to people making an argument for defensive voting, like voting against a tax increase or something like that. I'm sympathetic to those arguments, but I would never do it myself.
Yeah, I am too, and you know, I gave up voting about a year ago, but I was going to go vote for Ron Paul just to add one number to the popularity contest. But I recently decided I'm not even going to do that. And, you know, there's like in Casper here in our county, Natrona County, they have a 1 cent sales tax on top of the 4 or 5% state tax, not income tax. We don't have one, but, sales tax. So they're trying to add another penny to that tax to build a new library, which I think is completely ridiculous. And they're having town hall meetings about it. It's like, I wrote the speech in my head. I'd give it that town hall meeting and then just thought, I'm not even going, man. It's going to happen anyway. People are sheep. You know, I don't need to out myself to my neighbors as the crazy guy. And what's the point? I mean, it's to the point where like, the city takes money from the 1% so-called voluntary tax that everyone has to pay, but they vote in every 2 years, and they take money from that fund to buy billboards and radio ads to get people to vote for it.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And I definitely sympathize with the people that will go and I guess, you know, not only defensively vote against it, but maybe use that stage as
I do too. I like it. Did you see John Bush's video in Austin?
Yes, I did.
That was amazing. That was very well done. I wrote him a fan letter. I didn't know him from Adam, and I wrote him a fan letter based on that, but I wouldn't do it personally.
Yeah, I think, you know, I take the stance of I live as freely as I can and ignore the state as much as I can. I want them to have as little effect on my life as possible, which includes, you know, me feeling obligated to do certain things or not do certain things because of them. So I just try to limit their effect on my life as much as I can and you know, keep, you know, preaching the gospel, so to speak, to unsuspecting souls on the street as I walk around and do my thing. I was going to bring up another kind of conversation I had with a couple of guys on the street actually in front of that same farmer's market. It's kind of weird that my activism seems to come around that. But
to center around it centers around the hippie food store.
Yeah, I mean, it's fertile ground. I mean, it's absolutely fertile ground. I was walking out of the store, and I saw two guys petitioning for Planned Parenthood, and I walked up to them, and I just wanted to double check, and I was like, oh, you know, you are petitioning for more government funding of Planned Parenthood. And like, yeah, you know, women's rights and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, yeah, I can't sign that petition. Like, why not? I was like, I'm not for government funding Planned Parenthood or government funding anything at all. And then they kind of look at me like, what?
Well, all hippies are activists. I've never really tried to turn hippies like that. I have gotten a few emails from people who describe themselves as hippies who saw the Guns and Weed movie and quit being against people having guns, which I felt was a coup. But I've never talked to them in person. I lived in San Francisco for 16 years. I mean, I know hippies. And they're all activists, but they're all activists of wanting to point the government guns in their direction. You know, Planned Parenthood, I really think, could survive without government funding. I would send them a couple $100 if they lost their government funding because, you know, I got a vasectomy at Planned Parenthood about 15 years ago, and that probably saved me a lot of money in my lifetime in some way or another.
Yeah, and that was one of the points I made to them was that, you know, if Planned Parenthood is as fantastic as they are selling on the street, then Planned Parenthood would have no problem whatsoever existing in the market. You know, it's like Apple doesn't have any problem existing because they sell sweet products. And, you know, Taco Bell certainly doesn't have any problem existing in the marketplace. So I was like, you know, you guys, I definitely sympathize with where you're coming from, with the good that you see that they're doing, but, you know, the good that they're doing is coming from your money or your life scenario.
Look at the difference between the federal government census that you have to fill out or you'll go to jail, and Taco Bell, who will pay you money to fill out a questionnaire, or they'll enter you in a contest to fill out a questionnaire.
Yeah.
It's like, who's providing the better service there?
Yeah, that's the funny thing about it is that when you really break it down, it's like as soon as the gun is entered into the relationship, you know it's exactly what the person didn't want to do. You know, you only see the gun when the person doesn't want you to do what you want them to do. You know, how do you know the girl didn't want to have sex? Well, because she had a knife to her throat. That's how I know. That's pretty much the rule of thumb.
You're saying that rape is a good analogy for government. I kind of agree.
Yeah, and I've been slightly criticized for making that analogy before, but I think it's pretty pertinent.
I could see people. Oh, that's horrible. Look, I've been raped. I'll say it's a valid analogy, and I have been raped as a kid.
You have a better understanding of.
I will stick up for your right to say government is like rape. I would say rape is less bad because, you know, my rape happened once and, you know, kind of fucked me up for years in a way, but I can opt out of ever having that happen again. I can't opt out of government. I can opt out of ever being raped again by the fact that I carry a gun with me everywhere I go and, you know how to not get into situations where someone could corner me and grab the gun or something. So. Government is worse than rape.
Yeah, that's exactly what Lysander Spooner said in the mid-19th century when he said that, you know, a highwayman who robs you is much better than a government because for a couple of reasons. One, the highwayman doesn't pretend to be your benefactor and to do it on your behalf and be doing it in a way that is helping you. And B, the highwayman robs you once and then leaves you alone. He doesn't come back every year, every month.
Yeah, and so, I've heard the government compared to the mafia, and I would say the mafia is better because the mafia demands protection money, and if you pay it, they don't continue to hurt you. The government demands protection money and uses it to hurt you for nonviolent things.
Yeah. I mean, it's the private extortions pale in comparison to the public extortions by a long shot.
You're listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. That proves you're smarter than most people.
So, redemption in the third act. Can you talk a little bit more about some cheery, uplifting cases of turning statists into heading towards non-statism, and or talk about where you see America or the geographical location known as America when you are an old man? Go.
Oh, man. I'll loosely talk about some of the experiences I've had. I think some tips that I could bestow upon the listeners for having conversations with folks is, one, definitely engage them on subjects that they're familiar with and they're comfortable with and that they can identify with, because talking about, you know, even dead children in Afghanistan is so much more ancillary to somebody's life than something that they have experienced before. And so, you know, using the raw milk thing with the chick at the store who I knew was into raw milk, or something like, you know, you have a friend that gets busted for pot, and then you can kind of point out the obvious gun in the room that was, you know, minutes before was sticking in their ribs, things like that, that helps them to feel the gun in the room. I mean, you can talk about the gun in the room, but I think it's important if they can see it themselves and they can feel it. And even taxation is hard for people to feel on the same level as some of the other things that they might identify with. And so I think that going
taxes are kind of hidden. Taxes are sort of hidden, you know, in sales tax, in the price of things, you know, the sales tax down the line from the manufacturer, you know, income tax, they steal it and then give you some back and everyone goes, oh, the government gave me money, you know, so they kind of hide it. They're pretty clever about that.
Yeah. And it's just something, you know, with the withholding that, you know, you don't even see it. So, I think having them familiarize themselves with, what that feels like, and then, eventually you kind of work into other areas where they're less familiar, they're less inclined to agree perhaps, and then they're going to have, you know, they're going to play 100 questions about, well, how would this work? Well, how would this work? Well, how would they get that? And so you have to deal eventually with those questions. But I feel like dealing with those annoying counterfactuals and theoretical states of, you know, what would happen if, and then you get some scare story. I guess I've come to embrace that, because once you get to that point, you've made a lot of headway.
I've quit talking about who would take care of the roads with people. I've quit answering that. And when people demand an answer, I send them to the first 50 episodes of Freedom Fiends, because we covered it at length. I'm going with the Stefan Molyneux thing now of, that doesn't matter. It's the moral thing. It's like, you know, saying who'd take care of the roads would be like someone in 1850 saying, but who would pick the cotton if we freed the slaves? No, you free the slaves and then it figures itself out.
Yeah, that's one approach that you can take. I mean, there's several different ways that you can deal with those questions, but my point would be that, like, getting to that point is a win in itself, because at that point they're curious enough and they're working through it in their head. And what you'll notice is that you can get to that point and then they ask those questions and you might be a little annoyed and you start answering them. Then they start asking those questions and then answering them themselves. And they'll say, well, what about this? Oh, wait, well, then that could happen. So it's this fantastic progression that I've seen 100 times now, with people going from you're crazy to skepticism to finally accepting, you know, being on the same terms, and then wondering how would this work, how would this work, how would this work, and then they start figuring out how it would work in their heads. And then once somebody feels comfortable with this theoretical scenario in their head, then you got them. You know, but that's one step in the process that really trips people up and gets people really annoyed, is the what-if scenarios. But I really have come to, I guess, embrace it, because it means I'm that much closer, and I've seen this turn, like I said, 100 times over. I've seen the turn of events. It's the same, almost the same course of events every time. So that's, I think, my tip would be, don't, if somebody's curious and somebody has a modicum of intelligence, then that's pretty much all it requires, is a genuine curiosity and a dash of intelligence and no allegiance to some side, that some fictitious side, you know, and you can get them. Get them. Why I'm describing it like in terms of Ghostbusters and the library scene.
I like it, man. Thanks, Justin Longo. I think that's a good redemption in the third act.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Worms.
Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. When you're not busy spying on your neighbors or squinting at everyone, tell anyone who will listen why more government is a good thing. You'll get a warm and fuzzy feeling demanding more taxes and arguing in favor of gun control while militarizing our police, because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
That is so square. Check out the additional Freedom Fiend show, Freedom Fiends Live, every Sunday on the LRN.FM streaming feed or satellite radio.
Broadcasting live and worldwide from a windowless bunker inside a mountain near an undisclosed location in the rural Wild West of the occupied states of America.
Freedom Fiends Live expands on the Fiends' weekly Wednesday podcasts, but now we're kicking the hornet's nest live. Talk back to the back talkers every Sunday from 5 to 7 p.m. East Coast time. From the makers of Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. Freedom Fiends Live. Call in soon before we get droned.
Since time began, tyrants have taken aim at personal liberties. Now there's a movie that aims back.
The government has no more right to tell us what to put in our bodies than they have to take our guns or tell us what books we can read.
Six drug police were eaten by bears while raiding a marijuana farm.
On your knees, you dirty hippies!
Jesus.
On your knees!
What's the problem, officer?
Today, many cops who enforce pot laws do so only because it provides them with cushy jobs, good benefits, and a chance to push people around.
I was an undercover narcotics officer. The drug war is nothing but a farce.
The Second Amendment says you gotta keep you and your gat intact.
Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. A film by Michael W. Dean and Nima Vadadi.
DVD available now at gunsandweed.com or on Amazon. That's gunsandweed.com. Makes the perfect gift. Remember, that's gunsandweed.com.
Thank you for listening to the Anarchy Gumbo Podcast. Subscribe at kittyfeet.com. That's kittyfeet.com. All with a rotating guest on a spit, barbecued for your pleasure.
Outtakes, yay.